Students, the NAACP chapter of Rutgers, all of them are behind the parents, and they're going to continue this fight to insist that the healthcare industry find another place to build this hospital.
And yet the school board voted to sell the school.
And the school board
is
not
listening.
So
what happens next?
Well, what happens next is that they're going to continue to fight because it's not done yet. The Latino Justice, the civil rights group, has gotten involved. There are going to be lawsuits, and they're going to be even more escalating protests over the next few days.
Well, Rutgers University Professor Juan Gonzalez, thank you so much for that analysis. And, of course, Democracy Now! Co-host. That does it for our show. Tune in Tuesday night for Democracy Now! Super Tuesday live special broadcast with The Intercept from 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to midnight, right here at democracynow.org and on many stations around the country. We have a number of positions that we are hiring for in our newsroom, outreach and development teams, information application deadlines at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriana Contreras. I'm Amy Goodwin-Gonzalez.
That was a quick one, Amy. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM. The KBOO Evening News is next after these brief messages from KBOO. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of 15X, Friday, February 28th, from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. 15X is a local hip-hop show that features a wide variety of local hip-hop and R&B artists from Portland. Again, that's 15X on Friday, February 28th, from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center, 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, I'm Bob Madar. Join me for episode 5 of the third season of Local Folks Podcast and meet Rick, the manager of Project Action at the Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center. Rick was formerly homeless and now devotes his time to helping local folks who are homeless change their lives and find employment and housing. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folk.
KBOO Community Radio will be holding a volunteer orientation on Tuesday, March 3rd from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. The orientation will be at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Ave, near East Burnside. For more information, you can log on to kboo.fm or send an email to volunteer@kboo.org. See you there!
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, coronavirus response in Oregon gears up as the global economy suffers from pandemic anxieties.
The trial of Portland climate activists who blocked railways to Zenith Energy ends in a mistrial.
And the federal regulators come out against the removal of dams on the Lower Snake River.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 28th, 2020. I'm Clara Schotto.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. Though there aren't any confirmed cases of coronavirus in Oregon and the risk of contracting the disease remains low, Governor Kate Brown announced the creation of a coronavirus response team to prepare for a potential outbreak. This week, the Oregon Health Authority said it is monitoring 76 people for the virus who have traveled to China recently or who have ties to someone who has. The Oregon team includes representatives from the Health Authority, State Police, and the Oregon Military Department. The team plans to meet regularly to coordinate response to and preparation for the virus and will make recommendations to the governor. In a statement, Governor Brown said, quote, "In an escalating global health crisis, we must make sure we are as ready and informed as we can be," end quote.
Increasing anxieties about the spread of coronavirus have sent world stock markets tumbling today. with the largest weekly fall since the 2008 global financial crisis. According to Reuters, all three major U.S. indexes of the economy, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ, are on track for their steepest weekly pullback since the Great Recession. $5 trillion have been lost in global market value this week, and the decline hasn't shown signs of slowing. Coronavirus fears don't just impact manufacturing, but also international travel, supply chains, and school closures. The 2020 Olympics in Tokyo may be called off due to the virus. In California, a second coronavirus case of unknown origin has been confirmed, indicating that the virus is spreading in the state. The U.S. Federal Reserve is expected to cut interest rates next month in an attempt to cushion the blow to the stock market.
The trial of five climate activists who blocked the railroad route to Zenith Energy in April of 2019 ended in a mistrial Thursday. The five built a garden on top of Portland train tracks leading to the oil company. The jury could not reach a verdict in the case, though there is little debate that the defendants, including nationally known climate activist Ken Ward, committed misdemeanor criminal trespass. Lawyers for the activists from the Civil Liberties Defense Center made the argument that the injury or harm caused by the trespassing is less than that caused by the climate change the activists were protesting. This defense is called the climate necessity defense and has been used in court for 40-some years, but it has not resulted in acquittal. While it isn't a victory in the traditional sense, the defendants considered it so, with five of six jurors voting to acquit, according to the defense team.
A district court judge has denied a request to put a temporary restraining order on the new city housing screening that takes effect on March 1st. Multifamily Northwest and two landlords filed against the new ordinances, saying the rulings were unconstitutional and ultimately should never go into effect. As the Oregonian reported today, the judge denied the request, saying that the nearly year-long gap between the passage of the measures and the suit brought last Friday implied, quote, a lack of urgency or a lack of irreparable harm, end quote. The new housing screening processes are called Fair Access and Housing, and they were passed by the Portland City Council in June. It limits some of the things landlords can screen for, like felony convictions older than 7 years and misdemeanor offenses older than 3 years. Screening requirements for income and credit score have also been reduced. Landlords do not have to use the criteria outlined by the city, but if they choose not to, they must provide the applicant a written rationale for their denial and allow them a chance to respond to the issue. Commissioner Chloe Daly championed this policy as a way to open up housing to more people in Portland. While the policy doesn't make housing more affordable, it can make it more accessible. The Portland Housing Bureau has been offering free training for landlords in the new ordinances.
Federal regulators have rejected the idea of removing four hydroelectric dams on the Lower Snake River. Environmental activists have been pushing for dam removal to restore salmon habitat, which has been reduced by the dams. The dams are blamed for killing endangered salmon and steelhead migrating to the ocean or back to their spawning grounds. According to the draft environmental impact statement, breaching the dams would destabilize the power grid, increase greenhouse emissions, and raise the risk of power outages. On February 15th, Oregon Governor Kate Brown sent a letter to Washington Governor Jay Inslee in support of breaching the dams, saying it is the best way to increase the endangered salmon runs, which angered Washington's Republican House members. These dams are part of a 14-dam system. The impact statement is not yet finalized, and the public will have 45 days to give their comments.
South Carolina primaries are tomorrow, and former Vice President Biden leads in the poll, followed by the winner of the first three contests, Senator Bernie Sanders and businessman Tom Steyer. Some Republican South Carolinians may vote for Sanders because they want closed primaries. With that story and more, it's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
I intend to win South Carolina, and I will win the African-American vote here in South Carolina.
Former Vice President Joe Biden leads by 20 points in yesterday's Monmouth University South Carolina poll, ahead of tomorrow's first-in-the-South Democratic primary. Senator Bernie Sanders and businessman Tom Steyer are neck and neck behind him. In Charleston recently, Martin Luther King III, the oldest son of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., encouraged voters to consider environmental inequality, which disproportionately affects low-income and minority communities, when choosing a candidate. Ordained minister Dallas Conyers from South Carolina Interfaith Power and Light says climate change is her top priority.
I only look at the candidates who have even a minimum understanding of climate issues. Some of them talk about it, they have no clue.
Meanwhile, South Carolina Republicans are critical of the process itself. They canceled their primary last fall to save money, according to Republican political organizer Stacey Shea. Shea has long argued against the open primary system, which allows people to vote in either party's contest, no matter their registered affiliation. She claims Democrats take advantage of the system, a charge both parties have made over the years in states with open primaries.
In a lot of areas in South Carolina, they don't have competitive races, so the only voice that they feel they get is to vote in our primaries.
But ACLU South Carolina's legal director, Susan Dunn, favors keeping them open.
There are a lot of people who, for a variety of different reasons, don't want to make a permanent declaration of what party they're in. And to exclude those people from having their votes count in a pretty important process just seems undemocratic to me.
Stacey Shea's Facebook page, Registration by Party SC, encourages South Carolina Republicans to vote for Sanders to counter Biden's frontrunner status in the state.
It was really a mathematical assessment that we did to choose which other candidate to get behind. The only candidate in striking distance of Joe Biden is Bernie Sanders.
As Sanders rises in national polls, some establishment Democrats tell the New York Times they're willing to, quote, risk intraparty damage to stop his nomination, unquote, at the convention in July. Yesterday, Reuters reported the White House might invoke a law, the Defense Protection Act, to combat the spread of coronavirus. It would allow the president to expand production of protective masks and clothing as a matter of national security. Democratic candidates continue to question the Trump administration's response to the virus, including putting Vice President Mike Pence in charge of the federal effort. Pence has been criticized for how he handled the 2015 HIV outbreak in Indiana while governor. Bloomberg, for example, launched a national ad saying the administration's not prepared.
Number one, he fired the pandemic team 2 years ago. Number two, he's been defunding Centers for Disease Control, so we don't have the experts in place that we need.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks to 2020 Talks intern Danny Gare, and thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the upcoming Black Census Summit event. At 5:30, hear Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low around 40 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy as well with a high of 49. Today in history, in 1929, architect Frank Gehry was born. Gehry is known for his unique style, which was often defies categorization, but is rooted in modernism and is often marked with metallic flowing exteriors. His many designs include the Museum of Pop Culture in Seattle, as well as 8th Spruce Street in New York City, notable for being 1 foot taller than the Trump Tower, which was previously the city's tallest residential building. The quote of the day is from Gehry, who said, quote, "Architecture is a small piece of this human equation, but for those of us who practice it, we believe it in its potential to make a difference, to enlighten and to enrich the human experience, to penetrate the barriers of misunderstanding, and provide a beautiful context for life's drama," end quote.
Native and environmental groups are again asking for an injunction against the Keystone XL pipeline in South Dakota. The pipeline would transport tar sands oil, a type of oil that is widely considered as corrosive and dangerous, which has also the potential to contaminate sensitive habitats. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonio Gonzalez. Opponents to the Keystone XL pipeline have again asked a Montana federal judge to impose a preliminary injunction on the project. Indigenous Environmental Network and North Coast Rivers Alliance say President Trump acted illegally when he gave the project a permit in 2019. Victoria Wicks reports.
TC Energy, also known as TransCanada, earlier reported to the court that it intends to start pre-construction activities for the Keystone XL pipeline toward the end end of February. But now the court has set a hearing date in the middle of April to consider whether the pipeline can legally go forward. That's about the time TC Energy had intended to construct the 1.2-mile stretch of pipeline that crosses the border between Saskatchewan and Montana. In the request for an injunction, environmentalists note that the short stretch crosses a tributary of Whitewater Creek that flows into the Missouri River, so pollution could affect downstream consumption and irrigation. And they say the entire pipeline is dependent on that first mile, so building the border crossing enables another 875 miles of pipe. Stephen Volker represents the Indigenous Environmental Network. In his filing, he includes a transcript of TC Energy's February 13th telephone conference on last year's fourth quarter earnings. Volker cites comments made by TC executives that the project needs approval by the Army Corps of Engineers and resolution of the Montana lawsuit before the company moves forward to a final investment decision. Volker included the information to show that the company won't suffer harm from an injunction because the project is still in limbo. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Two Alaska Native weavers are being honored for their contributions to the field of traditional arts with U.S. Artists Awards. Claire Strimple spoke with one of the women in Southeast Alaska and has this report.
We'll go upstairs to my weaving room. It used to be one of the bedrooms, but...
Warm light floods the upstairs room where Lonnie Hotch weaves. Robes and regalia that she's made are laid over a daybed. One of them is part of her traditional Tlingit regalia, and the second of nearly a dozen major works that she's woven or helped to weave.
And when we wear our regalia, it's to show who we are. And because I was born in Klukwan, it's right across the street, next to this river, I really identify with it, with the river, and feel very connected to it. You know, I see it. It flows by my house here. And so I really, it's a part of who I am.
It's this work and the stories that are woven into Hotch's robes that earned her a national fellowship for visionary work in traditional arts. Dolores Churchill, a weaver from Ketchikan, was also selected. Churchill has been recognized for her Haida basket weaving with numerous other awards. Both women use techniques of Chilkat weaving in their art.
It's very gratifying. I mean, to me, you know, it can't fix all the problems in the world, you know, but I can bloom where I'm planted. I can make this little area more beautiful somehow with the artwork. That adds to our quality of life, don't you think?
This year's United States Artists Award is intended to thank makers for their contributions to culture and community. The fellows receive $50,000 to spend at their discretion. Reporting in Klukwan, I'm Claire Strimple.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Earth has a newly discovered mini-moon in its orbit, for now. The mini-moon, called 2020 CD3, was found by NASA, a NASA-funded project in Arizona called the Catalina Sky Survey. It's about the size of a compact car, and astronomers estimate it has been in Earth's orbit for around 3 years. The mini-moon is likely an asteroid from the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, which hit Earth's gravitational field and just the right speed and the right angle to become captured. This is only the second asteroid known to have orbited Earth, but the mini-moon is on its way out, astronomers say. Based in its trajectory, the mini-moon will leave Earth's orbit sometime in April and will switch back to a heliocentric orbit, meaning a return to orbit around the Sun. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 28th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Daniel Conway, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Antonio Gonzalez and Lily Bulkey. The director of evening news is Althea Billings, and a podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 VH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Claire Rosciato.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Be sure and stay tuned for our news in depth, talking about Black Census Summit coming up here in Portland.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The 2020 census is a present issue for people across the United States, and the threat of an undercount of the population can have real consequences. Census dollars are tied to population, and an undercount can result in less federal funding for the state. There are a number of hard-to-count populations in Oregon and around the country, including Black people, Indigenous people, people of color, immigrants, refugees, young children, and the elderly. To try to combat the potential undercount, this Saturday, February 29th, the Portland African American Leadership Forum is partnering with We Count Oregon to offer the Black Census Summit. The summit will be an opportunity for people who identify as African American, Black, African, or who are of African descent to learn more about the census process and become advocates for a proper count in their communities. To expand accessibility, the summit will also provide child care and translation services. KBOO's Althea Billings has more.
So we have in studio today with us Ray Mayer, the Census Equity Manager with the Portland African American Leadership Forum. The Leadership Forum is joining with hashtag WeCountOregon and a number of other groups to offer the Black Census Summit this weekend. Thank you for being here, Ray.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm so excited to be here and talk more about the summit and the campaign and the census.
Sweet. So yeah, let's start by talking about the census itself. It's taken every 10 years and it endeavors to count every person who's residing in the United States. And in turn, those, you know, people counts are used for a lot of really important things. But one of them has to do with political representation.
Definitely. I mean, it is a count of all living people. But what we find happening with the census is that there are hard to count communities. So the We Count Oregon campaign is working to make sure that these communities get counted. So hard to count communities need more in-person engagement before they take the census. So the amount of money that we get from the federal government is directly tied to the count that we have. We want to make sure everybody's counted in Oregon, and that's the work that we're doing on the We Count Oregon campaign.
Right. And so what are those ramifications if the population isn't counted correctly?
For every person that doesn't get counted, that's $3,200 per person for the next 10 years. That equals to about $13 billion for the state of Oregon. And Oregon as a state, a lot of our budget comes from that federal dollars. We need that. And census dollars is tied to the quality of life. We all use census dollars, even if we don't think about it. The roads that you use, right? Programs at school, the hospitals that we use, SNAP, Medicaid, Section 8 vouchers.
And so you mentioned hard-to-count populations. Who is included in those populations?
Yes, hard-to-count communities include Black people, Indigenous people, people of color, immigrants, refugees, houseless people, children under five. You know, people often think you don't need to count children under five or the elderly, but they need to get counted too. And newborns need to get counted. If that baby was born after the 1st of April, count the baby.
Right. And so I mean, I guess let's talk about the converse. What is the significance of an equitable and fair census? What do we get if we get that?
Yeah, well, you know, when the census first started in 1790, not everybody was counted in the same way. And so the census today is a tool for our communities to use to show that we are here. We live here, we love here, we thrive here in the state of Oregon, right? I mean, this is our chance to rewrite the narrative of what the state of Oregon looks like. There is a certain narrative and idea of, you know, who lives in Oregon, right? But the census, that data gets used to say who lives in Oregon. And we want to make sure that we portray the picture of the vibrancy of communities of color, you know, that they are really the heart and soul of the state of Oregon, and they deserve to be accurately counted and accurately represented.
So with all of that said, tell us about this event. What is the Black Census Summit?
The Black Census Summit is a part of our summit tour, so the Week on Oregon campaign. Right now, we are in our education phase, and a part of that phase are summits. So we had our Native Summit, we had two Latinx summits, great success, and we're so excited about the Black Census Summit, which is happening during Black History Month. It's the last day, and it's just a day. It's a day of community, music, and food, and census training. So this is a chance for community members to become ambassadors of the campaign. You know, we are embarking on a very ambitious project, and this project is to count every single hard-to-count person in the state of Oregon. But we need your help. We need ambassadors to help us get the word out, do the trainings. And remember, for hard-to-count communities, it's all about in-person engagement, right? Talk to people about the census. And when you come to the Black Census Summit, we'll give you all the tools that you need to mobilize communities and to make sure that your community gets counted.
What is the experience of the census for hard-to-count populations without ambassadors that you're training?
Yeah, so, you know, there's just a lot of, especially in the Black community, there's a lot of fear around the census, right? For good reason, but people are scared that, you know, the government can use your information against you. People are afraid that, you know, your information can be shared with your landlord. But there's actually something called Title 13 that protects your information. And it's one of the strongest laws. It's ironclad. You know, enumerators, they take oaths that they will not share your information for 72 years. And if they do, they can face a prison sentence of up to 5 years, or a fine of up to $250,000, or both. Your information is safe. It will not get shared with any authorities. It's illegal for them to do so. And that's really the message that we're trying to push. It is safe to take the census.
Yeah, and so you addressed this a little bit, but I want to get at, what is the importance of training people who identify as African American, Black, African, or who are of African descent in the census?
Yeah, so with this campaign is a community-led campaign. So we are outside of the U.S. Census Bureau, and we are working in the communities. We understand how to talk to our communities. We don't want to talk down to them. We want to connect with them and engage with them, right? It's important that we have these ambassadors come from the community, because they are what we call trusted messengers. And trusted messengers are really the people that is going to get the word out for that in-person engagement, to talk to people about taking the census. You know, our ideal outcome of this is that before, we want everyone to take the census, but we know that before hard-to-count communities take it, they need that in-person engagement. And that's why we need ambassadors, and it's a chance to become a part of a historical campaign. This work has never been done in the state of Oregon. It's being led by Black and Indigenous women of color, and this is a chance for people to become a part of this history-making campaign.
That's awesome. And so what do you hope attendees get out of this training?
So the Week on Oregon campaign is a community-led campaign. And we are outside of the U.S. Census Bureau, and it's a coalition of about 13 Black and Brown-led organizations across the state. And, you know, the exciting thing is that each of these organizations are going to be hiring census field teams. So we're going to be looking for census organizers, and this is really a chance for folks to make a difference in the community, to get the word out about the census. So PELF will be hiring a census field team. Our hiring event is coming up. And again, for information about the summit and for information about hiring and any other opportunities, please go to paalf.org. That's PELF.org. It's a day-long training. It's a day of community. We'll give you all the tools that you need. We'll give you all the resources, the materials, the presentations, the scripts, everything that you could possibly need to go out and do trainings in your community about the census. You'll be plugged in to the campaign. We will have spokesperson trainings, ambassador trainings, trainings around what is the census. We'll speak about frequently asked questions, FAQs. We'll speak about talking points. At the end of the summit, you know, you won't just leave feeling good, being in community and feeling good, eating food from Key's Loaded Kitchen and everybody eats PDX. You will leave with a folder of information that you can then use to do your own Get Out the Count campaign.
You know, in anticipation of the upcoming census, Oregon is expected to get another seat in the U.S. House of Representatives as a result of population growth. How does that potential new addition play into the conversation around an equitable census taking?
Yeah, so we missed that seat in 2010 by such a small margin. And there's an expected 450,000 new residents in the state of Oregon. If we get everybody counted, we can get that seat. An extra seat equals more representation, and it's another chance for our voices to be heard. You know, hard-to-count communities don't often have a chance for their voices to be heard and don't often have a chance for political representation, right? But we want to change that. And the census is one of the ways that we can do that. The census is one of the ways that we can shift power. So it's so important to get an accurate and a complete count, because that's what makes the census equitable and just. A just and equitable census means that everyone is counted, and everyone is counted fairly and equally.
Is there anything else you'd like to impart to our listeners today?
Yes. Census Day is on 1 April 2020. It's also my birthday. Hey, if you would like Ray to have happy birthday, please take the census. So starting in March, you'll get census mailings, and that mailing will tell you exactly what you need to do to take the census. On your mailing, you'll have your unique census ID, and that's really all that you need to take the census. This year is exciting. It's the first time we can take the census online, but you can still take the census by mail or by phone. And the We Count Oregon campaign also has Census Assistance Centers, CACs, throughout the state. And those folks are trained to assist you to take the census. It's accessible to take it. It's safe to take it. It's easy to take it. The questions have stayed the same. 10 questions, 10 minutes.